Today's topic is reconciliation, but not as we often speak of it in terms of racial injustice and oppression, such as the work of the South African and Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. Instead, it's applying the principles of those commissions to gender inequality and the work of gender reconciliation, which is applicable across all nations and for all people on the planet. My collaborator on this subject is John Sungmin Guy, a certified facilitator through Gender Equity and Reconciliation International. John shares his insights as a professional and from personal experience as he reflects on the privileges he has had as a cisgendered man and the marginalization he's experienced due to racism. His work is informed and supported by Buddhism, in particular, the practice of noticing how we cause harm. A large part of this is bearing witness as a way to transform our understanding of the human condition, to expand it beyond our personal views and opinions to be more open so we can genuinely be with one another. Content notification, we discuss sexual harassment and abuse in this episode. Hi, John. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
So to begin, could you just talk a little bit about growing up and the point at which you started to step into the realm of being service?
Oh, wow. Such a question.
I know. This is the question I ask
well,
all of my people.
Yeah. I know. And yet when it comes at you, you don't know. So, I grew up in various places. I grew up in a Navy family and grew up in a Black family. And so there was always this stress on, you know, the world's not exactly fair and you got to do what you can anyways. So that got my attention about, you know, the state of the world and things like that. And I think it was probably around college time when I started studying so critical sociology, they called it, and, you know, learning about feminist theory and these critiques of modern critiques by philosophers and stuff of society and all this kind of thing. And so it just kind of like raised my awareness about the state of the world and the state of the human beings and suffering. And it really caught my attention and caught my heart's attention, I think. And I think decided to be of service at that time, but didn't quite know about how to go about doing that until later. I studied sociology and then wound up going to Japan for a year, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, teach in English, and then came back and then eventually learned about Naropa University and wound up going there to do a master's degree in Eastern Western psychology. And through that, introduction to Buddhist practice, to mindfulness practice, really just getting in touch with myself, being out in nature longer, and being really just connected to other human beings from a deeper place than kind of the headspace that I'd experienced in the corporate world and business world and out workaday world. Probably when I started really wanting to be of service, I was very inspired by the Bodhisattva path, the Bodhisattva vow, and wound up taking that. And that was like my heart's longing coming into being. So I'd say probably around 2005 or so.
Yeah. Oh, I completely identify with that. I remember when I first started learning about Bodhisattvas, and I did do an entire episode of Bodhisattvas for listeners, but effectively, it's somebody who is willing to postpone their own enlightenment for the sake of being of benefit to other beings. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that whole concept to me, I was like, yes, where do I sign up?
Yeah, I don't know why. I think of it as a firefighter's vow, you know, get everybody else out before this place burns down.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. Or was it the captain of the ship, right? You make sure everyone's off the ship. And if that means you go down with your ship, So you've got a lot of different qualifications and credentials, like you've done studying in quite a few different areas, as you already mentioned. But what I find very interesting is that you are a certified facilitator through Gender Reconciliation International. But first, mm-hmm. I didn't even know that organization existed.
Right.
So that is interesting.
Yeah, it's funny because it's based here in the States. It's actually based in just south of you in Washington State. But most of our work until recently has gotten its most notice in South Africa, where the meaning of reconciliation, as you know about South Africa and the history of apartheid and everything.
Yes.
Their understanding of what reconciliation is, a very evolved understanding of how to bring parties together and understand the past and work through differences. So we did a lot of work out there before getting more noticed in the States. A little bit now. So yeah, I'm bringing our work out here. And we're now called Gender Equity and Reconciliation because of some confusion in the States around what we mean by reconciliation. And so bringing this idea of understanding that how gender has been an area of a lot of wounding throughout history in all kinds of contexts. That's something we're trying to bring to the States more now.
So language is really important. It's something that I always like to ask for clarification, and so that moving forward, people are basically going from the same playbook. So how do you define reconciliation, and how do you define gender equity?
Well, so reconciliation, I suppose, it's funny, I don't have a formal definition of it, but I think the way we would talk about it in a workshop, because we mainly do workshops, is coming to a deep mutual understanding of one another's lived experience in the world. And we do that, you know, through structured sharing, through creating safe space, and creating spaces where people can deeply listen to one another, hear each other's pain, and come to terms with how they may have participated in causing pain for others, but also uplifting and celebrating and honoring each other for their experience. So that, if that serves as a definition. And then the gender equity and reconciliation piece is really about understanding that, well, yeah, as I said before a little bit, that there's been this historical oppression based on gender, around gender identity, sexual orientation, all of these things from way, way, way back. And that these things still manifest today in everything from religion. We say from the bedroom to the boardroom. And really just want to bring healing to that space. And so we've organized, I would say, over 100 workshops in India and South Africa and Colombia and Australia and England and the United States. And yeah, for a long time. Mm-hmm. And bringing participants together to hear each other's experience from a deep lived place and move through it and understand one another.
So I think a key part of this in doing this kind of work, and this is something that's come up with most of my guests, is the importance of cultivating self-awareness and really how you start with yourself in order to do this kind of work. And then actually, if you don't have a really solid home ground, you can't do this kind of work effectively, or you can't do it for very long. So what has been your experience of healing and understanding around gender equity and like your role and your experience in reconciliation? And especially because you've got that, and I think this is something that people take for granted, that when you come from a marginalized community, you couldn't possibly discriminate against other communities. But obviously that's not true.
Right.
So like, if you could talk a little bit about like your experience of racism and how that relates to the work that you do around gender equity, and if it does relate, or what your experience has been with that, what your home ground is basically in establishing it.
Right. And right now we're talking about intersectionality, right? And
yeah.
And for me, it's been a powerful tool because, you know, I guess it'd be good for clarity to say that I identify as a cis hetero male. So I'm like basically steeped in the patriarchy and didn't question it in any way, right? until I was at least in my 20s and started reading about feminism and all this stuff. And so, yeah, I think we go through a very long training. I mean, I think it started for me with my Buddhist training at Naropa, and just really sitting with the experience I had had as a cis hetero boy growing up, and really feeling its impact on me, the kind of you know, pushing into the man box that a lot of other people have talked about, which sent me into a depressive spiral in my early 20s, and realizing slowly in the course of becoming a gender reconciliation facilitator that that is part of the wounding that then I pass on to others in my unconscious patriarchal kind of privilege. So the whole process of becoming a facilitator is one where you begin mapping out what we call, you know, our gender lifeline, right? Like, so we begin reflecting back on our gendered experience, all the gendered experiences we may have had, the difficult as well as the joyful ones, mm-hmm. and slowly surface those into light. And I think that has been both my Buddhist practice and then through the gender reconciliation work and becoming a facilitator, becoming aware. For me, I tend to stress how I harm others, because from my understanding as a Buddhist is that as we bring awareness to our habitual patterns, we begin to see how we cause harm to ourselves and how we cause harm to others. Mm-hmm. And so I don't stress that to be negative, but I stress the awareness of how I cause harm to others, because it's becoming aware of it is exactly how I stop doing it.
Yeah.
And that process becomes difficult and painful sometimes, but it's also joyful and liberating, which is part of a lot of what we do in that work, is kind of the joyful uplift of bringing things into the light and surfacing them into the light of, we say, into the light of love, like to kind of quote Martin Luther King, you know?
Yeah. Oh, the Dharma of Martin Luther King. Definitely. So let's talk a bit about the Me Too campaign, hashtag Me Too.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So it is an interesting campaign, because very quickly intersectionality became part of the conversation, because initially there was this sense that it was about women sharing their experiences of sexual harassment. And then you would get people who were saying, well, you know, I am not part of a gender binary and I've experienced it too. And then you would get men who were saying, yes, I've experienced this too. And there is always that risk when a man steps into a space and says, oh, I've experienced this too, of it detracting from the experience that women have had, or that trans individuals have had, or non-binary people have had, where it's like really making it back about men again. But because it's sort of understanding that the reason that men can't come forward very easily about experiencing abuse is for the exact same reason that women can't come forward about experiencing abuse, or why women are so hesitant to, because they're often not believed, but for different reasons than why men aren't believed. And for me, that was like a big takeaway for me from watching that and watching the dynamics play out and seeing how people kind of miss that. Seeing that it's the same toxic masculinity that leads to sexual violence, it's the same toxic masculinity that prevents men from speaking out. Either against what they see or from their own experience of it as well.
Yeah, it's funny because I completely agree with that. And we talk about that when we do the gender equity work, that the suffering perpetuated by the patriarchy affects men as well as women. I'm cautious when men say that, though, because like you said, I think the danger can shift the spotlight to men. And I have no intention of doing that. I think that men do suffer, but we have to work amongst ourselves, because we're also the main benefactors oftentimes of that very system. And so I think this is like one of those places where my racial identity helps me out, because while I may suffer from the privilege of patriarchy, if I may suffer from a privilege, I guess it's kind of, I guess this is just a personal opinion, but it's more important for me to stop the causing of harm to others. And so for me, it becomes very important in the Me Too campaign to, like, I found myself responding very little. I had several, of course, like lots of men say this, right? Because it's everywhere and everybody's experiencing it. But several posts, and I chose really to read and absorb. And I found that that is part of the power of the reconciliation work, much of what we do, because I don't know if you've experienced this, Kate, but when you try to speak up about oppression that you've experienced and pain that has come about, because I've experienced that with race, and then somebody says something and they haven't really taken that into their own heart and let it transform them. Mm-hmm. And so in the reconciliation work, what we try to do is create spaces. Oftentimes what that looks like is what we call silent witness. And so we'll have people, non-binary people in the center of group speaking to each other, to themselves about their experience while others are sitting in silent witness and just taking this into their hearts in order to be transformed. So yeah, I find myself both agreeing with you. I definitely suffered from patriarchy, but I don't need to make that my thing. I don't need to, like,
Yeah.
I would rather men listen more closely to other genders and really learn about what other people experience. I guess that's kind of my takeaway from the privileged parts of my identity. I feel need to sit in witness and kind of like heartfelt witness to others.
In learning how to observe the conversation without the need to jump into it.
Observe it and take it in. And if I can come into like meaningful dialogue with someone, and I guess this is also my bias, right? Like I don't often find my threads in social media to be like deep, like I prefer the face-to-face thing. I think that's just my, you know, my training as a therapist.
Yeah, I think that's just sort of sensible for doing any of this kind of work. I've very rarely met people who are genuinely skillful in having these kinds of conversations online. In fact, I know two people that I follow who are genuinely skillful at doing it. And it's amazing. I wish I had those skills. I try to cultivate them, but yeah, it's not necessarily the space to have it. What for you has been your experience of seeing things from that bigger expansive view? Because I think that's like such an essential part of this. Like we get so locked down into our personal view and experience, and we do have to start from ourselves and where we are. But what has been your experience about basically stepping out from that experience, that limited experience, to be able to see things from that bigger view? And they're like, oh, right, that's all connected.
Well, my experience has been that happens through the heart. And I think that mindfulness practice itself, which I should say is a big part of the gender equity and reconciliation work as well, is because we use mindfulness as well as other other spiritual traditions. You could imagine if we're doing this work all over the world, we have to be able to work skillfully in other religious traditions as well. But we always are using mindfulness, whether we call it that or not, in order to help people settle into themselves and open their whole being to one another. And so for me, the bridge to that broader understanding is creating a space where people can take it in and feel not attacked. So not attacked or blamed. And this is where the skillful facilitation comes in, I think, in terms of the work that I do, whether it be, you know, in the therapy office or in gender reconciliation or in racial work that I do, is about really inviting people to the understanding that it's not, right? None of us created what we were born into.
Right.
And yet we're all partaking of this and we're all in the midst of it together, in this soup together. And without, you know, spiritually bypassing, right? And this is where the asking to take another person's pain into your own heart has that transformative quality. And once that happens, then we can see that it's like, it's not that I'm bad. It's not that I'm alone here in my experience. I can connect across to others who share the same experience as I do, the same background as I do. And I can begin to see how this whole thing plays out between people and historically and systemically, right? Mm-hmm. I guess that summary is just that through the heart and through mindfulness and through openness and awareness.
It's really that interconnected quality, being able to see interconnection.
Really that egolessness, right?
Yeah. Actually, so... Oh, that brings up a whole other question. I was going to bring us back to bearing witness, but I think I'll run with this one for a little bit then. What has been your experience of egolessness? And maybe like describe how you understand egolessness. Yeah.
You're asking me to turn the wheel of Dharma or something. No, I'm just joking.
Totally am. It's like a warrior exam up in here.
Right. What has been my experience? Well, I mean, I feel like there's, you mean you can describe it with different language, I guess. But if you're asking me from that personal level, I liked how my program, contemplative counseling psychology, talked about it in terms of exchange, mm-hmm. right? And we talked about this notion that because we're not boundaried, we have the capacity to experience someone else's experience within ourselves if we're willing to open up to it. And so there's this process that I experience in the counseling relationship and in groups of all kinds, where if I'm really, you know how you have that experience in mindfulness practice where sometimes I think of it as listening very, very deeply to one's own being, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're there, you're on day 32 of a retreat or whatever, and you're like, oh my God. But at the same time, you've got this deep, I keep using the word deep, but just this profound silence in which your own experience is arising. And if you do that while sitting with another and listening to their experience, you begin to hear the resonances of their being within your own. And so I feel like that's how I've experienced it. And I might say further that one of the most beautiful ways I've experienced it, at least in the gender work, the reconciliation work, is near the end of workshops where people have gone through this deep listening process with one another, sitting in what we call truth forums and listening to one another's truths. And then at the end, where we do like a celebratory, an honoring ceremony to uplift and bless each other's experience. And there is often this luminous, transcendent, beautiful quality in the room, right? Like you're, mm-hmm. like for a reason that I can't explain other than, you know, from this perspective of mindfulness of like exchange, and we've sat and really tasted each other's experience deeply, mm-hmm. and realized through that, not through some heady dialogical intellectual process, but through simply opening ourselves to really genuinely be with one another, mm-hmm. we get to experience that, I don't know if you want to call it oneness or egolessness, that real genuine connection.
Mm-hmm. And actually then that does tie in, I feel ties in really well to circling back to bearing witness and what you're describing about being present for people's pain. Mm-hmm. I've got loads of experience with learning how to be present with my pain and how that has then right. translated into being present right. with other people's pain. But I'd love mm-hmm. to hear a little bit about your practices around that or things that you've used and how you've done that kind of work of showing up for yourself so you can show up for others.
Yeah, my work has been primarily on the cushion and in my own therapy as well, but I'd say even more so on the cushion and through practices like Tonglen, through metta practice. I feel like I heard about this so many times on your interviews. and just as I'm sitting there on the cushion, as I become vulnerable to myself, that's how I experience the mindfulness practices. Becoming vulnerable to my own experience, and you know, memories come up, experiences come up, and they're painful. And I'm asked, right, through at least through the teachings, I'm asked to be lovingly aware of what is arising for me. And I often like to describe it with my clients in psychotherapy as like holding your own experience like it was a baby crying in pain or sadness or hunger. You know, like you don't like put the baby down and walk away, right? You put your arms around it and you cuddle it and cradle it and coo to it. And that's often how I think of working with my own pain as it's arising. And I'll do that on the cushion. I'll do that in my counseling sessions. I'll do that in the gender equity and reconciliation work as I'm facilitating a difficult circle where men are sharing their experience of abuse or sexual violence, or even painful stories where they're opening up and they're sharing about the ways they've transgressed, if you want to call it that, and hurt others, and mm-hmm. really hearing, feeling that pain, taking it in, because I may have transgressed and hurt others, and I know I have been hurt, and I can feel that, and so I'm holding that like a baby, and then the Tonglen practice of breathing that in, transforming it, connecting it to some other positive experience and offering that back as healing, as love, as light, as whatever comes to mind in the moment. So I'd say Tonglen and Metta are big parts of the practice of working with my own pain and then working with my pain in the midst of working with others, which is the fun part.
Could you talk a little bit about what you've learned about knowing your audience and the importance of not doing the emotional labor for other people?
Oh, what brought up that question? It seems very connected, but I'm not sure how you got there.
It was primarily because of what you're talking about when someone is sharing their pain, either like opening up about the harm that they have caused or sharing about harm that was done. But I think especially when it's opening up about harm that was caused, a lot of the time I see people and I feel it in myself, this need to step in and be like, it's okay. When really, like, they need to hear that for themselves, right? Like, that sort of, like, how you put it, it's not about giving somebody an out, basically.
Right.
To not sit with the fact that it's painful to acknowledge that you've caused harm. And I think I'm really thinking about it from, like, that's what you said really early on there about how you do this work from a place of looking at how you've caused harm. And I think for most people, that's probably really hard. It's really easy for us to see how other people have caused harm to us, but we're often a lot less willing to look at how we cause harm. And I know in my own experience of learning how to do the emotional labor for the harm I've caused and to really own it and sit with that. And yeah, I've hurt people.
But how to not do that work for others?
Yeah, basically how to not step in so that people have the opportunity to own it. You know, like if someone had ever said to me about some of the things I've done work around, well, it's okay, don't worry about it. I'd be like, well, no, because if I don't genuinely sit with this discomfort and really get to know it, there's a chance I'll repeat the behavior. And I don't want to repeat the behavior. So,
right.
Yeah.
You're awesome. yeah, that's my take on it too. I think partly, you know, I have these models in my head, like developmental models. And one of them that I've kind of come to, or I guess has become kind of implicit for me, because there probably are academic models for this kind of developmental thing around intersectional pain and stuff like that. But what I've noticed a lot in the work that I do is there is a necessary stage of grieving that one goes through when they're awakening to their own, to the harm they may have caused, and also to their own as well. But when they're in that phase, I'm guilty of having been, my reaction is often like, okay, hurry up, get past the guilt phase, because you need to change our, you know, and so. So I wind up really, again, the mindfulness practice of slowing down and practicing being with, rather than, I guess, you know, from a therapeutic perspective, it would be considered therapeutic aggression, like my need to like push others to hurry up through that phase. You know?
Yeah.
And so really just that willingness to be with others' pain as it's arising. I feel like I'm talking so much about pain, and yet there's so much joy in the work that I do. But I feel like the necessary factor is like going through that to transform that darkness, that pain, into joy, into light, into healing and love. But you can't get there. You can't get there by trying to go around it. So,
yeah.
So for me, it's the being with, and just recognizing that this person, whether, you know, if it's myself on the cushion or even in the workshops where I'm recognizing something about myself, and it just, okay, I have to be with this like I do with anything, and love my experience and love this other person going through this experience.
Okay. We could talk about joy if you want to talk about joy. I'm all for that. I guess... to like pedal back and talk a bit about pain first again.
Yeah.
And what you're saying about like you have to go through that to get to the joy. And I've been doing a little bit of like really examining pain versus suffering. And so like the way I can't remember who said it, but that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional.
It's optional. Yeah. I love that saying.
Yeah, I don't know where that came
I love
from.
what do they say in Dharma? They talk about heaping pain on top of pain. Ow, that hurt. I'm gonna make it hurt more. I'm gonna beat myself up over it. I'm gonna
Yes, exactly. I guess to clarify then, like my understanding where I am at that right now is that, you know, pain is old age, sickness, and death, to put the Buddhist bent on it. So if we're lucky, we'll get old, and getting old isn't necessarily the greatest comfortable experience, but it does beat the alternative, which is death, and then sickness, and you know, sickness is deeply unpleasant. Those are things that are just, they happen. They're not a punishment, which is a whole other conversation. But suffering, my understanding, is resistance to that. So suffering is resisting the inevitability of pain. Mm-hmm. So to bring it back then to the joy is, when you're talking about working through the pain, what I understand is like you're really talking about peeling away the layers that create suffering around the pain so that we can be really open to pain as a part of life. From that place, then we can experience a lot of joy even in the midst of pain. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Tell me why it makes sense to you.
I mean, I think the key in it is the word that you said about resistance. And that's what I experience in the intersectional work is, you know, for example, working with doing couples counseling with people who are two different races. And there's this way that one person may not want to take in the pain that the other person is talking about. Like I went through this today and it was really horrible. And the other person's, because they don't have that in that, they can't locate that in their experience. They resist hearing it. And so it's like, they don't want to take it in. And then that causes them to become anxious and upset and uptight. And then the other person becomes anxious, upset, and uptight because they don't want to, they want to be accepted as a whole being, but they can't get that from their partner. And so, you know,
yeah.
So how can we just relax? And for me, the peeling away of the layers is the relaxing that resistance, like dropping the thought, dropping the reaction, and being with, okay, this person is saying this to me. Can I just open to it, and hear it, and hear the pain in them, and feel that resonate back and forth without pushing it away, without trying to change it, without trying to like come back at them with a rationalization or an explanation of why it might be that way, you mm-hmm. know, or that it could be something else, or you probably didn't see that right, you probably didn't get that right, you know, or they didn't mean that,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see as the peeling away those layers of resistance. And it's funny because you know I feel like I'm shifting those contexts a lot, you know, from one-on-one work to group work to couples work, but as the couple goes through this together and they begin to relax and open to each other's experience, then they're starting to experience that reconnection, mm-hmm. connection to one another. Oh, if I just let go of my resistance and hear you, I can be close to you again, right?
Which is very joyful.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's also sort of connecting with the poignancy around things. So
the simultaneous pain pleasure thing.
Yeah, like there's something very poignant about, say, the best example I can think of that I always think of is the pain of grief,
mm-hmm.
which can also be a very joyful time because of the. Mm-hmm. The memories and the sense and like the connection, you know, it's, oh, how does it get described? It's like funerals are unplanned family reunions. And sometimes like that can be such a wonderful experience actually, because you're brought together with a lot of people around the mutual love that you had for someone and from someone. So that's like, yeah, very like that poignancy, that's what I mean. It's like that sense, that feeling of connection and, even in something as devastating as grief can feel at times.
Yeah, I loved them. There was this talk that Indigenous teacher Martine Prechtel said about pain and grief being two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot praise what we have not grieved. We cannot grieve what we didn't praise when we had that person close to us.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I would like to really just hear a little bit about how your views have changed over time. Because you talked about like your first sort of noticing things and getting interested in stuff in your first studies, and then where you are now with just gender reconciliation. What have been some noticeable shifts in your views in that time, in this work that you've been doing?
I think one part of the answer for that is, at least with regard to race, I can see that when I was younger, before I started doing this work, before I developed this game that I made to help people understand each other across racial differences and stuff, I think it was easy for me to believe that I would never, you know, that I would never. And then through getting involved in counseling and psychotherapy, through getting involved in group work, group facilitation, and deeply listening to others, through getting involved in really exploring racial issues and reading about them, and then really exploring the gender equity and reconciliation work, like, of course I'm capable. and you know, and I've had to like imagine a world, right? Like, no, I haven't watched that movie White Man's Burden, but I've heard of it several times. And that idea that things could be reversed. And yeah, we might perpetuate suffering as well. I think that's one of the biggest things that has changed for me, especially seeing my own complicity in patriarchy and all of that kind of stuff. Just the view that I know I'm innocent and good and pure of heart. Which I laugh at. like, of course I am. But knowing that so much of it is unconscious and mm-hmm. not intended for me, it really helps take the sting out of that. So I think my view around that, around my own innocence, may have changed. And that sounds negative too, but I don't experience it as negative. I experience it as like joyful to be able to stand up for something meaningful.
And
to be able to advocate for myself more strongly and advocate for others more strongly. It's all been a positive shift. That's one answer.
Yeah, I totally agree. I have a very similar experience with that. It's like you can't change that which you do not acknowledge or look at. So it's quite empowering. Did you have any other thoughts you wanted to add to it, or are you ready for the final question?
Well, I don't know about others, but I know that I've apparently came as a surprise to me, but that I invested a lot into not wanting to touch my own woundedness around intersectional issues of all kinds. And I think that has been a big thing that has shifted in my view. I mean, it's funny because you asked that question about working with your own pain, but I feel like that for me was a revolutionary shift. I mean, before I started my mindfulness practice, I had nowhere to go with it, right? I had nowhere to go mm-hmm. with it. Like, I was filled up with pain from race and gender wounding and that kind of stuff. And all I knew how to do was walk around and either be, you know, I remember having my hoodie up and grumbling and upset with the world and like projecting anger outwards, you know? Mm-hmm. And as I learned to open to myself and to open to my own experience, that was the transformation of that view, that it doesn't need to be held on to. And not only does it not need to be held on to, that it can be transformed and transmuted with awareness, with conscious attention, with compassionate connection to other beings and listening to their experience. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So my final question is always basically an invitation for you to offer any gifts or guidance, as you would, however you want to think about it, to listeners who are doing this kind of work.
Gifts or guidance? I guess I want to support anybody thinking about doing this kind of work. Like, your efforts in this regard and in regards to healing gender wounds, race wounds, all of these things that we experience as human beings on the planet in this mix with each other, it's so deeply needed, so deeply needed. I just, please come join us. And the joy of joining with others in this kind of work far outweighs the sorrows, far outweighs it. The fun, the connections that are made, the community that is made. Yeah, I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't trade it. So come join us.
Come down join
with
us.
Patriarchy, up with love. That's what I say.
Oh, it's fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the conversation. It's been really fruitful to hear the questions and to be able to reflect and take it deeper.
John Sungmin Guy has a master's in contemplative counseling psychology and is a licensed mental health counselor in private practice in Washington, as well as a facilitator with Gender Equity and Reconciliation International. You can learn more about his work and connect with John through his website, www.johnsungmeguy.com. You can find out more about gender reconciliation training at genderreconciliationinternational.org. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.